This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At her funeral on Sunday, fellow comedians praised Joan Rivers for her sharp wit and fearless performances.
I came back through San Francisco, and I had two shows there. I have a really terrific agent. First show, I played to all blind people, which, very hard. My mother was blind. I'm sick of blind people. I'll tell you, if you're blind in this audience, just tap out. I'm so sorry. Blind people are so f***ing selfish. It's all about them. When was the last time a blind person gave you a compliment? Think about it. You look great. Have you lost weight? Never happens.
What really made Joan Rivers funny? Well, my next guest has a theory. Peter McGraw is a marketing and psychology professor and director of the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado, where he studies what makes us laugh and why. He's also co-author of The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny. Professor McGraw, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with that Joan Rivers clip we just played. Made me cringe just a little bit. She's making fun of blind people. So why are people laughing?
Well, it helps to be a Joan Rivers fan, I think. So certainly the issue of why are people laughing is closely connected to why aren't other people laughing. And the short answer is that the people laughing see how that situation is wrong, yet okay. Or in our academic speak, a benign violation.
What is benign violation theory?
So the idea is that the things that we laugh at, if you think about it, laughter is a tool of communication. It's a behavior meant to communicate with others. And the idea is that we live in a world of things that are scary and the things that are wrong, that are amiss. And yet, in a certain smaller set of circumstances, the things that seem amiss are actually in some way okay, acceptable, or safe, or as we say, a violation is benign. And you delight in those situations because they're not really bad, and you laugh to communicate to others that this seemingly bad thing is actually okay. But what makes something wrong, what makes something okay, it depends on context, depends on the person delivering it, depends on the person's values and beliefs of the person hearing it. And so Joan's able to do this in part because she says things that are wrong about herself all the time. Technically, also, she is right. It may be in poor taste, but technically that's true in the sense that if you lack sight, then you lack the ability to make those kinds of observations about the world.
Okay, so true, the teller. And the situation is a violation, but the situation is benign. Do all of those things have to be present to make something funny?
We think so. Yeah, the idea is that if a situation is totally benign, there's nothing arousing, there's nothing exciting, there's nothing threatening about it. It's why you can't tickle yourself. There's no actual attack there. Things that are pure violations, that are just purely wrong, they don't induce this kind of reaction. There's no reason to communicate to others that this bad situation's okay. So the creepy stranger who tries to tickle you on the street, there's nothing funny about that situation. So you have to bring those things both together when you're tickled by a loved one in a way that's not too aggressive. That, you get the delight, you get the laughter, and so on.
So what are some of the other forms of violation? Tickling, you mentioned. Play fighting is one that you talk about in your research. And linguistical norms. Let's hear just an example of a violation of a linguistical norm. Mitch Hedberg here on puns.
I order the club sandwich all the time, and I'm not even a member, man. I don't know how I get away with it. I like my sandwiches with three pieces of bread. So do I. Well, let's form a club then. Okay, but we need some more stipulations. Yes, we do. Instead of cutting the sandwich once, let's cut it again. Yes, four triangles. And we will position them into a circle. And in the middle, we will dump chips. Or a potato salad. Okay. Let me ask you a question. How you feel about frilly toothpicks? I'm form. Well, this club is form. Spread the word on menus nationwide.
So, Mitch Hedberg, joke about a club sandwich. Why is that funny?
Well, so wordplay, puns, and so on, purposely misuse language. And so he's, at the same time, misusing a term, misinterpreting what club means, while at the same time finding a way to make sense. You see this over and over again. So it's not okay to compliment your coworker's nice buns unless he or she has brought in some freshly baked buns, right? So you take this sort of taboo and there's an alternative meaning there that takes a violation and makes it benign.
I noticed one of the points in your research is a violation can seem benign because of a lack of commitment to the violated norm. So we've got an example of a joke here. The Sarah Silverman, never one to shy away from violation.
I wear this St. Christopher medal sometimes because I'm Jewish, but my boyfriend is Catholic, and it was cute the way he gave it to me. You know, he said, if it doesn't burn through my skin, it will protect me, which is, who cares? Different religions, you know? I mean, I guess the only time it's an issue, I suppose, would be, like, if you're having a baby, you got to figure out, like, how you want to raise your baby or whatever, you know, which wouldn't even still not be an issue for us because we'd be honest, you know, and just say, you know, like, mommy is one of the chosen people, and daddy believes that Jesus is magic.
So that's kind of joke that could take a real nosedive in some types of audiences. The audience has to play along. How so?
Yeah, so the notion is that there's sort of this sweet spot between telling a joke that's too tame and telling a joke that's too risque. And as you know, Sarah falls on the risque side too much. But your perceptions, your belief about what the topic is, your commitment to how important it is to be Jewish or Catholic, will certainly help or hurt that joke land in that way. So, you know, being a little bit more loose in the way you see religions and how you think about God helps you laugh at both the Jewish parts of that joke and the Christian parts of that joke. It ramps up the safety in those situations to try to help you get to that sweet spot. You change the audience, you change whether that joke lands.
Why is something funny? Well, we're talking to Peter McGraw. He's director of the Humor Research Lab at the University of Colorado and co-author of The Humor Code, a book about the global search for what makes things funny. Peter, I would love to know where you think this joke falls on the humor scale. It's a clip from the late comedian Patrice O'Neill from his 2011 stand-up special called Elephant in the Room.
What's his name? Joran Vandersloot? Right? We find out he was a serial killer. Man, he kills women. That's what he do. He do it well. You know what I mean? We know the girl that he, you know, supposedly had. What's the girl in Aruba? Natalie Holloway, right? But the one he just killed, a girl in Peru. What's her name? Exactly. We're gonna ask you. Said Natalie. You said Natalie. Natalie. I said that like Family Feud. All right, name a white girl been missing for 5 years in the room. Natalie Holloway. Survey says. Name a Peruvian girl that was killed yesterday.
So again, at face value, he's talking about the disappearance and murder of two young women. Now, why is that funny?
Again, this depends wholly on that audience, but What Patrice is doing, and I thought in general did very well, is this notion that we find time and time again that the best jokesters, the best comedians, want to speak truth to power. They want to point out the things that are wrong in the world. And there he sort of very cleverly is pointing out how the press seems to be overly interested in pretty blonde, blue-eyed victims. And for that joke to be funny, you sort of have to recognize that. You have to see that, and in many ways see that that's wrong. You know, he's engaging in satire. He's he's criticizing the press, and it's actually pretty hard to argue with him because he is right. You can't name that other victim. You don't know who it is.
Right.
And you can't name who that victim is because of the way the press has treated this.
So again, the conclusion that it's about the audience, but do certain people have a higher threshold for meaner, sharper, more satirical humor? Is this something that you can analyze by country, by culture, by region?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that because what we've been doing so far is doing something that for thousands of years scholars and thinkers and entertainers have tried to do, which is to try to deconstruct humor by using kind of thought experiments. Why is this funny? Why is that funny? But in the Humor Research Lab, we want to go beyond that. We don't want to engage in philosophy. We want to engage in psychology. And so you have to measure things. And ideally, what you do is you measure reactions after first manipulating certain aspects of the situation, changing the phrasing, changing the timing, changing the place that this joke is told in order to see, are people's reactions in line with your theory in this case? A benign violation approach. And so there are these individual differences. You can measure individual differences, for instance, with regard to things like disgust sensitivity. Some people are just easier to gross out than other people.
Mm-hmm.
And those things should, in the laboratory, translate into a greater or lesser appreciation for scatological comedy, for toilet jokes.
Are certain things universally funny, like a pratfall?
Yeah, so when you look at the list of violations that can occur in the world, the things that can go wrong, it definitely seems to be that the physical, the person slipping on some ice, stumbling up a set of stairs, or the slapstick comedy of the Three Stooges, seems to be the closest thing that you can find to things that people laugh at across ages, across gender, across cultures. It's why Super Bowl ads feature so much slapstick, because they're trying to appeal to such a large audience.
Are there some topics or instances that are never funny? I mean, we still don't really have 9/11 jokes, and it's been 13 years since 9/11.
So, it's been 13. You know, it's been 13 years. But The Onion published one of their most famous articles around that time, just 2 weeks afterwards. And what the writers of The Onion did, and my co-author and I found this out on our Humor Code travels, is that they didn't make jokes about the victims. They made jokes about the terrorists, which had a really great effect. One is that it helped introduce a bit of humor back into a world that was without it. But it also served this sort of subversive element that comedy can do. When you're laughing at terrorists, now you're not afraid of them.
Hmm.
And terrorism plays on fear. And so in that way, that issue really helped people heal, not only just through the laughter, but also it could change the way they think about these seemingly scary people.
We hear some of the headlines from The Onion's first issue. This is right after September 11th. Hijackers surprised to find themselves in hell. Not knowing what else to do, woman bakes American flag cake. Hugging up 76,000%. You've actually tried to apply your theories outside of your lab, and you tried stand-up comedy. How'd you do?
I didn't do so well. I find
that funny.
Yeah, people do, actually. Although my audience didn't, but people outside of the audience tend to. But I actually did try stand-up at a dive bar. I bombed. But that pushed me out of the laboratory. That caused the Humor Code Project. And at the end of the Humor Code Project, my co-author, Joel Warner, said he would only do the trips if, when we were finished, I would get on stage again to prove that I've learned something along the way.
Are you ready?
I did it.
You did?
I did. And I don't want to give it all away, but I can tell you that it had to have gone better.
Well, Peter McGraw, thank you so much.
That was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Peter McGraw is a marketing and psychology professor and director of the Humor Research Lab. That's at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and co-author of The Humor Code, a global search for what makes things funny. There's also a link to the Humor Code website where you can learn a lot about that Humor Code search. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And stay with us for Learning Through Laughter. We're going to hear about a teacher who uses stand-up comedy to help students discover their talents and to cope with teenage insecurities. That's when Word of Mouth continues on NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Brian Bowden is a teacher, not of the standard curriculum, but of stand-up comedy, which means not just nurturing students' talents, but helping them come to terms with their insecurities. This profile of Brian was produced by Annie Gilbertson as part of Deutsche Welle radio series Generation Change.
I love to laugh loud and long and clear. I love to laugh. It's getting worse every year.
My name's Brian Bowden. We're hanging out at the Second City Training Center. Here I teach stand-up comedy to 11 and 12-year-olds, 13 and 14-year-olds, 15 through 18-year-olds.
I took a stand-up class in the fall, Brian Bowden. The first thing that you talk to him, you think it'll just be like a normal conversation, and then he'll just say something really funny and bizarre.
Yeah, like one of the exercises I have students do is sort of write down a couple things that is odd or unique about themselves that generally people would not look favorably upon, and I want them to then write sort of a rant talking about how awesome this thing is.
Some people laugh through their teeth, goodness sakes, hissing and fizzing like snakes.
We do like a bunch of writing exercises, like taking two words and then trying to make a joke out of them, like two random words.
And people got, like, lascivious leger or, like, a demonic dragon, and you had to make a tattoo of that on you and then explain about how you got the tattoo.
Then there's a kind what can't make up their mind.
A lot of people get writer's block a lot, and it's because they think whatever they're putting down is stupid. But it's not. It's just a thought that isn't complete.
Like, some days I'll think I'm funny, and then some days I'll be like, I'm really not funny at all.
Confidence is important everywhere. If you're just telling someone a story or presenting an idea or something like that, and you keep questioning yourself, you need to be confident if you're going to get your ideas around.
So I've had some students who, you know, didn't do well with, you know, acting and improv and stuff, but did fantastic with stand-up. I've also seen a kid, a very nerdy kid, you know, very, like, low-confidence type kid, and he found with stand-up, he did really well. He really enjoyed it because he wasn't afraid. Like, in stand-up, it's okay for you to stand up on the stage and tell everybody, I'm a huge nerd, and it's like, yeah, we love it, you know. Whereas in real life, he goes to school and says, I'm a huge nerd. Everybody's like, shut up, punch you in the head. But he gets to do that. He gets to stand on stage and said, I'm a huge nerd. And he's like, oh, my God. And the class thought that he was the funniest person in the class. And I was teaching his dad at the same time. His dad was telling me that he was getting more confident, you know, girls were actually talking to him because he was doing stand-up, and they thought that was so brave.
I went to a girl's house that I really, really liked. We just broke up, and I pretty much went to her house. She lives in my neighborhood in the middle of the night and sang to her.
As long as it's tonight, I know it'll be all right.
Something like that. I'm not even sure. That's probably not even it. She rejected me. Hardcore. And it was hard.
I think, like, if you're a comedian, you definitely have, like, either insecurities or you see the world in a way that's way different from everyone else. Like, normal people, I guess, would just go through their life. But then comedians, they just, everything they look around, they're like, oh, that could be a funny joke.
Especially the teenage part. That's where you're becoming metacognitive. You're thinking about your own thinking. You're thinking about your place in the world. What's this mean? That's why a lot of teenagers do that whole, it's not fair, it's not fair, it's not fair, because they're realizing sort of their place in the grander scheme of things. And that place is horribly unfair a lot of times for teenagers. There's a lot that's not fair about being a teenager. you're not allowed to go to certain places, you can't go into certain things, can't say certain things, can't do certain things, you have to behave a very specific way.
It sounds like a teenager's going, man, nobody understands me, you know? But part of what makes comedians different is that we see the world in a different way.
And we're making observations from the outside. If you're outside looking in and you notice a mistake, maybe the person who's been doing something for quite a while is sort of stuck in a routine and they don't know how to improve or something like that.
And that piece, produced by Annie Gilbertson, it was part of Deutsche Welle Radio series Generation Change. Coming up after a break, any of these sound familiar? Oh, I never got your email. It must have gotten stuck in my spam folder. I left your voicemail. Didn't you get it? Or the familiar text, I'm on my way. Technology has given us a whole new set of excuses and tools for lying. Up next, we're going to turn the tables and look at how technology is deceiving us. That's coming up when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Fib, flim-flam, slander, fraud. Call it what you will, but it's fair to say that human beings are capable of lying in a number of ways. While our philosophical struggle with moral truth dates back to the ancient Greeks, it's a relatively new consideration for digital technology designers. Think about it for a moment. Is technology honest? When does technology lie to us and how? And is all dishonest design necessarily bad? Those are some of the questions Kate Green poses in an article for Pacific Standard Magazine called How Should We Program Computers to Deceive? Kate Green, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with some examples. Where may we have encountered deceptive technology without even realizing it?
Well, it's actually all around. And one of the more common examples is in placebo buttons. And if you haven't heard of these, you should probably know about them. They are these buttons that appear in elevators and also at crosswalks. And sometimes they just don't do anything. So you press the elevator close button and the elevator door doesn't close. It just goes on its own time. And you press a crosswalk button and it gives you some indication that you've pressed it, yes, but the actual crosswalk isn't set up to respond to the button press. It's more set up to respond to a timer. And so these buttons are deceptive in their design. They present themselves as a physical object that performs some function, but they don't actually do anything at all. And the idea is to basically give a person something to do, to calm them, to make them think that they have a sense of agency when they don't really.
Wow, that is fascinating. I actually didn't know about the placebo button and had never thought of them. Can you give us more examples of this kind of deceptive technology?
Sure. I mean, if you think about the computer that you use every day, you have a graphical user interface. It's really hiding a world of complex code behind it. And it's a form of deception. It's not really presenting the full picture to you. And this is a sort of deception that's benevolent. So this isn't so bad. We don't want to be inundated with the complexity of the computer code that's, you know, working behind the scenes. And so that's one example. But then there are others. Progress bars when you're uploading or downloading files oftentimes don't have any real association to reality.
So deceptive technology can make us feel calmer, as you said, make us feel a little bit more in control. Is there any evidence of other kinds of benefits?
Well, one example is to help us overcome our own preconceived limits. So one technological example is a robot that's designed to it's a rehabilitation robot that's designed to underreport the force that you exert. So if you have an arm injury or recovering from arm surgery and you need to get back in shape, you might not think that you can press a lever as hard as you actually can. And so when the robot or the interface underreports your force, course, you kind of exceed what you think you can do. And this is the same thing that happens when you're working with a personal trainer or a coach of some sort, and they cover up the treadmill display. And so you don't know how fast you're going. You just kind of put some faith in the trainer that their actions are meant to help you achieve your goals.
I can see, okay, you've got a human being who's a trainer who's saying, come on, push harder. You're not pushing hard enough. A robot doing the same kinds of thing and maybe getting the same results. But is there a difference between a deceptive machine and a deceptive human? Somehow it feels just more sinister that a machine would be lying to us.
Oh, certainly. And this just has to do with the way that we interact with technology today. So there's a scientific trope of machines that turn evil and turn against their human creators, you know, this Frankenstein fear. And right now, I think that we're pretty far away from that. But the fact of the matter is we are designing deception into our technology for better or for worse. There just isn't a loud conversation around it. And it's a conversation that should be happening because if we aren't thinking about the question of how do you program these things to be moral and ethically sound, you know, questions of how you integrate deception into the interface, then I think that there could be some problems.
So this is an active conversation among designers?
Well, it's not really. And that's what was so exciting for me. I came across this paper that was published last year, a paper called Benevolent Deception in Human-Computer Interaction. It was presented at the Computer-Human Interface Conference, the big one that happens every year. And it was written by Etan Adar of University of Michigan, Desney Tan of Microsoft, and Jamie Tavan of Microsoft. And these three researchers decided to kind of look at all the possible types of deception that they found in technology today. And, of course, it ranged from the benevolent, like we discussed earlier, to the malevolent. So these are the pop-up ads or the sort of interface technologies that that trick you into doing something you wouldn't want to do that only benefit the designer. Mm-hmm. And the it was just a compendium of all these deceptive designs, you know, for good or for bad. And so it was these researchers who wanted to get the conversation going because designers, by and large, believe that honesty is the best policy when it comes to design. And that dates back to Dieter Rams, who's a designer for Braun. And in the 1970s, he had his, you know, 10 principles of what good design is. And honesty was on there. And so the fact of the matter is, though, designers aren't always honest, but they don't want to talk about it. And so if we can just get the conversation to be a little bit more honest in and of itself, then maybe we can approach it from a more systematic way or something that really, from a way that really considers the consequences of this kind of design.
We're talking with the San Francisco-based writer Kate Green. She writes a lot about technology and science, about deceptive technology. Has technology changed the way we lie? I think it certainly has given us plenty of different excuses.
Right. So we feel like we're constantly connected. So many of us feel like we're constantly connected. And if someone asks us, where are you? You know, you feel an obligation to respond in a text. I'm on my way. That's a sort of very simple example of, are you really on your way? Well, I'm close enough. So that's a little white lie. And that's because we feel an obligation to respond in a lot of cases that, and this is something that technology has enabled. This sort of constant connectivity.
Yeah, I remember begging out of a dinner once with a friend and then stupidly reporting on the great movie that I saw that.
That's fantastic.
Well, we've explored how technology lies to us, but are there ways that technology, in the case that I said, might actually force us to be more honest?
Well, one of the things about the internet right now is that it has a pretty long memory. And so if you're someone who might want to be dishonest on a resume, it might not benefit you to put something dishonest on the long-lived Internet Archive. So that's one thing that might indicate that some people are being a little bit more honest and knowing that there's information that is kind of more easily findable and that there's a bit more of a record being kept of them.
All right. So when you think about deceptive technology and artificial intelligence 10, 20, 50 years from now, what might deceptive technology look like in that world with artificial intelligence?
Well, to be clear, I'm not necessarily advocating deceptive technology in artificial intelligence. I think that it's an extremely complex question. And it just really goes back into, you have to ask the basic question, how human do we want our technology to be? Mm-hmm. And if the answer to that is we want it to be as human as humans are, then we as humans need to really get a better handle on what deception actually is and how it's used and where it's beneficial and where it's not. And I think that that's just the sort of question that needs to be discussed across the board, not just designers, not just computer scientists, but I think philosophers and ethicists need to get into the conversation as well.
Kate Green, a San Francisco-based writer who covers science and technology. She's co-author of Reality Mining, Using Big Data to Engineer a Better World. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you'll find a link to read Kate's article that was written for Pacific Standard called How Should We Program Computers to Deceive? There's a link on our website at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for our conversation with Ryan Miller. He's frontman for the band Guster, which is going to be playing in Manchester this weekend. Guster blows in when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and you're listening to Do You Love Me off of Live Acoustic. It's a 2013 release from the pop band Guster. Born in Boston in the early 1990s, Guster first hit the pop charts in 99 with the song Fafa, and they've been drawing sellout crowds ever since. Guster's going to be performing in Manchester, New Hampshire at the Palace Theater on Friday, September the 12th. We spoke with Guster's guitarist and lead singer Ryan Miller early last year, back when they were touring this stripped-down album called Live Acoustic.
I don't know where I am, but I was just sitting in an Eames chair at a community college, so I was very happy about that.
That's pretty
I
good.
Took pictures. I know, I felt good. I was like, let's do it. By the way, that's the most I've listened to our new acoustic live record was just then when it was playing.
Wow, so you guys toss these things off and then what, you just move on?
No, I mean, this whole thing happened so quickly. You know, we did this tour last spring in April of 2012. We had been talking about doing an acoustic tour forever, and then we got these string arrangements, and we just kind of documented it just to do it. And then, I don't know, some email went around in, like, October or November, like, we're going to do an acoustic album. We need to name it in a day, and you need to, and we've already mixed it in. So I didn't even, that's why the name is so benign, Acoustic Live. Like, that's the worst name ever. How did that happen?
And we were kind of wondering how you came up with that.
Just terrible. The cover of that thing, I drew something on an iPad and I sent it, and like 10 minutes later it was the cover. It was so thrown together, and I never listened to it because I knew I couldn't change it. So I just listened to it. Sound pretty good.
Yeah, it does sound pretty good. And there is a kitty cat, by the way, on the cover. I should let our listeners know.
I'm not really a great artist. I probably shouldn't be doing cover art for albums.
Well, since we now know that you guys plan things so carefully, I'm curious about the rules for the acoustic tour. So what's the rule? You can plug in an amp, no pedals?
Yeah, well, we sort of, I mean, the main thing is that we're sitting down and that people are in seated venues, which we've never done before. I mean, we've always kind of fought against playing seated venues, even when we played you know, the music hall in Portsmouth, we always like encourage people to stand up right away. The goal at this point is to keep trying to challenge ourselves to do some interesting things. What can we do that's going to really shake things up, that's going to make things more interesting for us, more interesting for our fans? How can we interface with the music in a way that's not like, hey, here's this band and they're going to play Demons for the 7,000th time, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, let's hear one of those old songs that you dug up for the live album. This is a little bit from Rocket Ship. Now, this is originally off of the 1998 album Goldfly.
Morning sign for them. Read my apology. Their hope of disbelief. But no. Indicate no others in this time. I'm on for the rocket ship, prepared for something new. I'm on for the rocket ship, ecstatic with a view. Cause I am scared of the things that come in, and I want for the things I don't have.
That's the song Rocket Ship, performed by Guster from their new acoustic live record. Since we're auditioning this for you today, Ryan, what do you think?
That's weird. I'm kind of mad because I kind of wanted to get through life never having heard it. They're not really allowing me to do that.
Well, should I give you like a spoiler alert? You can just block your ears
exactly.
when we're going to play bits of your music.
You're going to be like, okay, you have 25 seconds. And I'll put my fingers. not listening to you. Not listening.
Well, one of the things this band, your band, is known for that, you know, so many people love about you, great pop hooks and lots of playing around with rhythm track. I want to know how to pronounce his name first. Your percussionist, Brian Rosenworcel.
Wow. Look at you.
Well, you know, I do. This is an NPR interview. You are
I
in
know.
An Eames chair.
We are next level there. I'm impressed.
Well, he's known for playing things almost exclusively with his hands. I'm wondering if he's using a drum set through this tour, or is he just going acoustic with
his
hands?
Yeah, no, he's doing more of the drum kit thing. There's sort of been all these different versions of our band, and I think these big distinct chapters, and I think the first like iteration of Guster was defined by Brian playing exclusively percussion parts. And then after we made our album Lost and Gone Forever in 1999, he was feeling really stifled creatively. You know, I think he felt like he was stuck playing these certain kind of rhythms and this certain kind of way. Eventually, you know, just as turning into adults and starting to understand music more, like, well, let's not be a gimmicky band. I mean, there was a moment, you know, that I had reading the liner notes of Lost and Gone Forever, that last album we did with percussion exclusively, and it's like all the sounds were made using hand drums, no sticks. It mm-hmm. was like, who cares? You know what I mean? Like, I remember seeing that too, like on a Rage Against the Machine, like Tom Morello, those aren't keyboard sounds, those are made using guitar. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't care about that stuff when I'm listening to music. I don't care if it's fake or if it's real or if it was recorded with a $1 million studio or like a 4-track at home, as long as it's working for the song.
Okay, well, plug your ears because we're going to hear another tune.
Oh, God, how long? I'll put
well,
it on my timer.
Let's see. I don't know, maybe 20 seconds.
Is this the first time you've done an interview where you had to warn the guy that you're about to play his music and to plug his ears?
Well, usually they're kind of behind the music that they're putting out there. I don't know.
Yeah. No, and I don't even think it's bad. I've been enjoying it. You know what? I'm going to unplug my ears for the next 20 seconds.
All right, how about this is Satellite, the hit single from your 2006 release,
okay.
Ganging Up on the Sun. Here's a live acoustic recording from the new album by Guster.
Yeah.
That's the song Satellite, and it's from the new Acoustic Live album from Guster. We're speaking with Ryan Miller of Guster. He's the guitarist, lead singer, and primary songwriter for the band. Ryan, you know, one of the things that struck me when I was listening to your songs anew with this album was thinking that, you know, they're sunny and optimistic, but deceptively so. You know, like, you're young, 21, everything's under control, and all that gets blown to bits.
Yeah.
What is that? Is that something in your personality?
For me, it was a lot of it came from just being a really big Smiths fan and a really big Morrissey fan, because I loved that about the Smiths, that mm-hmm. they wrote these massively poppy, crazy upbeat songs that was like, girlfriend in a coma, I know. For me, it always felt like we could get away singing these super sunny songs if there was some weight that was underneath them that would kind of keep them from floating away. Like that song, Do You Love Me? Like, it was the song, to me at least, is not, hey, do you love me? This is great. But it's about the dissolution of this relationship that kind of like just developed into this stagnant thing after 5 years. And the question isn't so much, we're falling in love and do you love me for the first time? It's more like, hey, we've been in this for 5 or 10 years and do you even love me anymore?
Well, that's a question that I think a lot of couples come to after 5 years. Now you've been together as a band, what, since the early 90s. Do you sometimes look at them and say, okay, do you still love me? Are we still doing this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, every record since probably Lost and Gone Forever, we'd always had to discover what it is we're trying to say. I mean, especially in the last 5 years, I mean, we all have kids. Between Brian, Adam, and I, we have 7 kids. We're not a cool new band. You know, I lived in Brooklyn for 12 years, and so I was constantly exposed to cool new bands and awesome new sounds, and it's my constant battle of, like, do we have something new to contribute? Because you see other bands that maybe go on a little bit further than they should. And it's like, okay, as soon as it starts slipping into pure nostalgia is when I want to stop. Thankfully, you know, like Easy Wonderful, our last album, felt like, okay, when we play those songs live, the energy doesn't dip. You know, there's not like people like, oh man, it's these songs. We don't want to hear these. But again, we have to earn that every record. It's not just a foregone conclusion that that's going to be the case.
Well, Ryan Miller, guitarist, vocalist, lead songwriter for the band Guster, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for your kind words, and thank you for exposing me to the live album we just released for the first time.
If that's all you will be, you'll be a waste of time.
That's our earlier conversation with Ryan Miller from Guster. Guster is going to be playing at the Palace Theater in Manchester on Friday. That's September the 12th. Their latest album is called Live Acoustic, and they've got a full-length album planned for January. And if the single Simple Machine is any indication, sounds like it's going to be quite a departure. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's plenty more at wordofmouthradio.org and also on our social media sites, Facebook and Twitter. Earlier in the show, we spoke with the director of the Humor Research Lab, who broke down the science of what makes people laugh. So we'd like to hear from you. Do you remember the hardest you ever laughed? We're talking uncontrollable, paroxysm, fits of laughter. To get your memory flowing, here's comedian and actor Zach Galifianakis on the Pete Holmes podcast, talking about the time he laughed the hardest.
Church service on Christmas Eve.
Oh, church laughter is the best.
The best, because you're not supposed to do
it. You're not supposed to do it.
We were singing Silent Night, and we were lighting candles at the same time, but my dad had a really bad wick. His wick was implanted into the wax, so he couldn't get his candle lit. Everybody, 500 people in the church have their candle lit. They're singing Silent Night. My dad's oblivious. I'm trying to light his candle. I'm like, Dad, we're on the third stanza here. Get this thing lit. The song's ending. He finally gets it lit. He brings it to the front of his face. And as soon as he brings it to the front of his face, everybody blows out their candle. It was the greatest time thing I've ever witnessed. I had this feeling in my gut that I've never laughed. I screamed in church. I went, and I had to leave.
So what was it for you? What set you off into fits of uncontrollable giggles? Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio. We'll be right back.